Welcome to Radio 5G with Michael Henry Dunn, Nancy Hopkins, and friends, a cosmic reality radio production.
When all the broken-hearted people living in the world agree, there will be an answer, let it be. For though they may be parted, there is still a chance that they will see. There will be an answer, let it be.
Oh, let it be. And you're live.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to Radio 5G. This is Michael Henry Dunn, here with my co-host Nancy L. Hopkins, and we are really glad to be able to share with you a pretty amazing piece of history that relates so closely to what we're seeing happen now, not only with the rollout of the toxic 5G network, but also politically, and with the push towards globalism and the rolling back of human rights. As we know, these are all tied in together when we're talking about 5G, because it began as a weapons and surveillance system. And it is not, in its technical essence, primarily a telecommunication system. What we have to share with you this morning, Nancy brought this forward. So good morning, Nancy. How are you doing?
Doing fine. Yep.
Okay.
I think people are going to find this half an hour really interesting, because it does. It takes us back, you know, to 1958 with Mike Wallace, and you talk about Huxley, because Huxley, just from perspective, I was 10 years old. I didn't know the guy. You know, I mean, just enough. But he was one of these people that, even if you had never read his book, you knew of the book. You knew his name.
Right.
You know, he was profoundly a part of my growing up as a, you know, and through, you know, so we have a lot of people that are my age, your age, you know, they'll get the point.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, I'm actually a big Aldous Huxley fan. This, what we're going to share with you is 30 minutes of an interview that Mike Wallace did with Aldous Huxley. In 1958, of course, Huxley is primarily known for his novel Brave New World, which is called a dystopian novel, you know, as opposed to utopia. A utopia is a perfect paradise, a future world, and a dystopia is a perfect nightmare, future world. George Orwell's 1984 is usually referred to as the dystopian, the nightmare dystopian one. Whereas Brave New World is the, you are given soma, this wonderful drug, which sort of conditions all, you know, emotions and normal human individuality out of you. But they use this lovely little drug that puts you on a, you know, gives you enough of a buzz that you don't really care about anything, and you're easily manipulated. Aldous Huxley came from a very prominent British family, very distinguished for their achievements in science. He was very wide-ranging in his accomplishments, not only as a novelist, as an essayist, as a poet, associated with the Bloomsbury Group, like T.S. Eliot, Virginia Woolf, people like that, and also noted for his deep interest in Eastern philosophy and meditation. He was a disciple of the group of Hindu swamis around the famous Swami Vivekananda, who first brought yoga meditation to the United States at the Chicago World's Fair in 1893. And he then settled in Los Angeles. One of the interesting things about Huxley is that he's also known for his early experiments with LSD. He wrote a book called The Doors of Perception, which was very influential on people like Timothy Leary, because he saw that part of the reason for addiction as a phenomenon in human beings, he saw as having to do with a yearning for transcendence, a yearning to go beyond this mundane humdrum reality and access divine reality, and that the human mind, that there are literally doors of perception in the brain, which this chemical, as we know, seems to open. And a lot of people were not aware that Huxley had died when he died because of the date on which he died. He died on November 22nd, 1963, which is, of course, the day on which President Kennedy was assassinated in Dallas. And he was dying of cancer, and he had asked his wife, Laura Huxley, to administer to him a dose of LSD as he was nearing death. I don't know if that's the way I'd choose to go, but I guess he wanted the door of perception open just a little wider as he was making his exit. The story goes that the news of JFK's assassination came over the radio into the household and those who were with him just as this was happening. And Laura Huxley urgently warned everybody, don't say anything about this at this, delicate moment of transition, because she wanted him to be able to depart in peace. And of course, this would have been horribly upsetting, as it was to the world. So anyway, this is, I think, a really good opportunity to look back at what he saw coming. Because in this discussion, he goes into his clear perceptions of the trends and where they will lead. Because he had access to the elite in Britain, he knew what the plans and strategy were. At one point he said, we are moving towards a world in which democracy will be all that anyone talks about, and as a reality, it will have vanished. It doesn't exist, but the illusion of it is all anybody's talking about. And that's what we're seeing going on right now, this circus of, right, left, red, blue, and the political chaos. Our democracy has been subverted. Well, it has, but not by the means that everybody's thinking it has, whether, you're on one side or the other. So we will then get back to how this applies to our current situation with 5G today. But first, Nancy's going to bring on for us this historic interview between Mike Wallace and the great English novelist and philosopher Aldous Huxley.
This is Aldous Huxley, a man haunted by a vision of hell on earth. A searing social critic, Mr. Huxley, 27 years ago, wrote Brave New World, a novel that predicted that someday the entire world would live under a frightful dictatorship. Today, Mr. Huxley says that his fictional world of horror is probably just around the corner for all of us. We'll find out why in a moment.
The Mike Wallace Interview, presented by the American Broadcasting Company in association with the Fund for the Republic, brings you a special television series discussing the problems of survival and freedom in America.
Good evening, I'm Mike Wallace. Tonight's guest, Aldous Huxley, is a man of letters, as disturbing as he is distinguished. Born in England, now a resident of California, Mr. Huxley has written some of the most electric novels and social criticism of this century. He's just finished a series of essays called Enemies of Freedom, in which he outlines and defines some of the threats to our freedom in the United States. And Mr. Huxley, right off the bat, let me ask you this. As you see it, who and what are the enemies of freedom here in the United States.
Well, I don't think you can say who in the United States. I don't think there are any sinister persons deliberately trying to rob people of their freedom. But I do think, first of all, that there are a number of impersonal forces which are pushing in the direction of less and less freedom. And I also think that there are a number of technological devices which anybody who wishes to use can use to accelerate this process of going away from freedom, of imposing control.
Well, what are these forces and these devices, Mr. Hudson?
I should say that there are two main impersonal forces. The first of them is not exceedingly important in the United States at the present time, though very important in other countries. This is the force which in general terms can be called overpopulation, the mounting pressure of population pressing upon existing resources. This, of course, is an extraordinary thing. Something is happening which has never happened in the world's history before. I mean, let's just take a simple fact that between the time of the birth of Christ and the landing of the Mayflower, the population of the Earth doubled. It rose from 250 million to probably 500 million. Today, the population of the Earth is rising at such a rate that it will double in half a century.
Well, why should overpopulation work to diminish our freedoms?
Well, in a number of ways. I mean, the experts in the field, like Harrison Brown, for example, pointed out that in the underdeveloped countries, actually the standard of living is at present falling, that people have less to eat and less goods per capita than they had 50 years ago. And as the position of these countries, the economic position, becomes more and more precarious, obviously the central government has to take over more and more responsibility for keeping the ship of state on an even keel. And then, of course, you're likely to get social unrest under such conditions, with again an intervention of the central government. So I think one sees here a pattern which seems to be pushing very strongly towards a totalitarian regime. And unfortunately, as in all these underdeveloped countries, the only highly organized political party is the Communist Party, it looks rather as though they will be the heirs to this unfortunate process, that they will step into the power position of power.
Well, then, ironically enough, one of the greatest forces against communism in the world, the Catholic Church, according to your thesis, would seem to be pushing us directly into the hands of the communists because they are against birth control.
Well, I think this strange paradox probably is true. There is an extraordinary situation, actually. I mean, one has to look at it, of course, from a biological point of view. The whole essence of biological life on Earth is a question of balance, and what we have done is to practice death control in a most intensive manner without balancing this with birth control at the other end. Consequently, the birth rates remain as high as they were, and death rates have fallen substantially.
All right, then. So much for the time being, anyway, for overpopulation. Another force that is diminishing our freedoms.
Well, another force which I think is very strongly operative in this country is the force of what may be called over-organization. As technology becomes more and more complicated, it becomes necessary to have more and more elaborate organizations, more hierarchical organizations. And incidentally, the advance of technology has been accompanied by an advance in the science of organization. It's now possible to make organizations on a larger scale than was ever possible before. And so that you have more and more people living their lives out as subordinates in these hierarchical systems controlled by bureaucracies, either the bureaucracies of big business or the bureaucracies of big government.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, the devices that you were talking about, are there specific devices or methods of communication which diminish our freedoms in addition to overpopulation and over-organization?
Well, there are certainly devices which can be used in this way. I mean, let us take, after all, a piece of very recent and very painful history is the propaganda used by Hitler, which was incredibly effective. I mean, what were Hitler's methods? Hitler used terror on the one kind, brute force on the one hand, but he also used a very efficient form of propaganda, which he was using every modern device at that time. He didn't have TV, but he had the radio, which he used to the fullest extent, and was able to impose his will on an immense mass of people. I mean, the Germans were a highly educated people.
Well, we're aware of all this, but how do you equate Hitler's use of propaganda with the way that propaganda, if you will, is used, let us say, here in the United States? Are you suggesting that there is a parallel?
Needless to say, it's not being used in this way now. But the point is, it seems to me, that there are methods at present available, methods superior in some respects to Hitler's method, which could be used in a bad situation. I mean, what I feel very strongly is that we mustn't be caught by surprise by our own advancing technology. This has happened again and again in history. Technology has advanced, and this changes social conditions, and suddenly people have found themselves in a situation which they didn't foresee and doing all sorts of things they didn't really want to do.
Well, now, what do you mean? Do you mean that we develop our television, but we don't know how to use it correctly? Is that the point that you're making?
Well, at present, the television, I think, is being used quite harmlessly. It's being used, I think, I would feel it's being used too much to distract everybody all the time. But, I mean, imagine, which must be the situation in all communist countries, where the television, where it exists, is always saying the same thing the whole time, is always driving along. It's not creating a wide front of distraction. It's creating a one-pointed drumming in of a single idea all the time. It's obviously an immensely powerful instrument.
Mm-hmm. So you're talking about the potential misuse of the instrument.
Exactly. We have, of course, all technology is in itself morally neutral. These are just powers which can either be used well or ill. It's the same thing with atomic energy. We can either use it to blow ourselves up, or we can use it as a substitute for the coal and the oil which are running out.
You've even written about the use of drugs in this light.
Well, now, this is a very interesting subject. I mean, in this book that you mentioned, this book of mine, Brave New World, I postulated a substance called Soma, which was a very versatile drug. It would make people feel happy in small doses. It would make them see visions in medium doses, and it would send them to sleep in large doses. Well, I don't think such a drug exists now, nor do I think it will ever exist, but we do have drugs which will do some of these things, and I think it's quite on the cards that we may have drugs which will profoundly change our mental states without doing us any harm. I mean, this is the pharmacological revolution which has taken place, that we have now powerful mind-changing drugs which, physiologically speaking, are almost costless. I mean, they are not like opium or like cocaine, which do change the state of mind, but leave terrible results physiologically and morally.
Mr. Huxley, in your new essays, you state that these various enemies of freedom are pushing us toward a real-life, brave new world, and you say that it's awaiting us just around the corner. First of all, can you detail for us what life in this brave new world, which you fear so much, what life might be like?
Well, to start with, I think this kind of the dictatorship of the future, I think, will be very unlike the dictatorships which we've been familiar with in the immediate past. I mean, take another book prophesying the future, which was a very remarkable book, George Orwell's 1984. Mm-hmm. Well, this book was written at the height of the Stalinist regime and just after the Hitler regime, and there he foresaw a dictatorship using entirely the methods of terror, the methods of physical violence. Now, I think what is going to happen in the future is the dictators will find, as the old saying goes, that you can do everything with bayonets except sit on them. But if you want to preserve your power indefinitely, you have to get the consent of the ruled. And this they will do, partly by drugs, as I foresaw in Brave New World, partly by these new techniques of propaganda. They will do it by bypassing the sort of rational side of man and appealing to his subconscious and his deeper emotions and his physiology even, and so making him actually love his slavery. I mean, I think this is the danger, that actually people may be in some ways happy under the new regime, but they will be happy in a situation where they oughtn't to be happy.
But let me ask you this. You're talking about a world that could take place within the confines of a totalitarian state. Hmm. Let's become more immediate, more urgent about it. We believe, anyway, that we live in democracy here in the United States. Do you believe that this brave new world that you talk about could, let's say in the next quarter century, the next century, could come here to our shores?
I think it could. I mean, that's why I feel it's so extremely important here and now to start thinking about these problems, not to let ourselves be taken by surprise by the new advances in technology. I mean, for example, in regard to the use of the drugs, we know there's enough evidence now for us to be able, on the basis of this evidence and using a certain amount of creative imagination, to foresee the kind of uses which could be made in by people of bad will with these things, and to attempt to forestall this. And in the same way, I think with these other methods of propaganda, we can foresee and we can do a good deal to forestall. I mean, after all, the price of freedom is eternal vigilance.
You write in Enemies of Freedom, you write specifically about the United States. You say this, writing about American political campaigns. You say, all that is needed is money and a candidate who can be coached to look sincere. Political principles and plans for specific action have come to lose most of their importance. The personality of the candidate, the way he is projected by the advertising experts, are the things that really matter.
Well, this is, during the last campaign, there was a great deal of this kind of statement by the advertising managers of the campaign parties, this idea that the candidates had to be merchandised as though they were soap or toothpaste, and that you had to depend entirely on the personality. I mean, the personality is important, but there are certainly people with an extremely amiable personality, particularly on TV, who might not necessarily be very good in positions of political trust.
Well, do you feel that men like Eisenhower, Stevenson, Nixon, with knowledge of forethought, were trying to pull the wool over the eyes of the American public?
No, but they were being advised by powerful advertising agencies who were making campaigns of a quite different kind from what had been made before. And I think we shall see probably all kinds of new devices coming into the picture. I mean, for example, this thing which got a good deal of publicity last autumn, a subliminal projection. I mean, as it stands, this thing, I think, is of no menace to us at the moment. But I was talking the other day to one of the people who has done most experimental work in the psychological laboratory with this, who was saying precisely this, that it is not at the moment a danger, but once you've established a principle that something works, you can be absolutely sure that the technology of it is going to improve steadily. And I mean, his view of the subject was that, maybe they will use it to some extent in the 1960 campaign, but they will probably use it a good deal and much more effectively in the 1964 campaign, because this is the kind of rate at which technology advances.
And we'll be persuaded to vote for a candidate that we do not know that we are being persuaded to vote for.
Exactly. I mean, this is a rather alarming feature, that you're being persuaded below the level of choice and reason.
In regard to advertising, which you mentioned just a little ago, in your writing, particularly in Enemies of Freedom, you attack Madison Avenue, which controls most of our television and radio advertising, newspaper advertising, and so forth. Why do you consistently attack the advertising agency?
Well, no, I think that advertisement plays a very necessary role, but the danger, it seems to me, in a democracy is this. I mean, what does a democracy depend on? A democracy depends on the individual voter making an intelligent and rational choice for what he regards as his enlightened self-interest in any given circumstance. But what these people are doing, I mean, what both for their particular purposes for selling goods and the dictatorial propagandists are doing is to try to bypass the rational side of man and to appeal directly to these unconscious forces below the surface, so that you are in a way making nonsense of the whole democratic procedure, which is based on conscious choice on rational grounds.
Of course, well, maybe you have just answered this next question, because in your essay you write about television commercials, not just political commercials, but television commercials as such. And how, as you put it, today's children walk around singing beer commercials and toothpaste commercials. And then you link this phenomenon in some way with the dangers of a dictatorship. Now, could you spell out the connection, or how do you feel that you have done so sufficiently?
Well, I mean, here, Kate, this whole question of children, I think, is a terribly important one, because children are quite clearly much more suggestible than the average grown-up. And, again, suppose that for one reason or another, all the propaganda was in the hands of one or very few agencies, you would have an extraordinarily powerful force playing on these children, who after all are going to grow up and be adults quite soon. I do think that this is not an immediate threat, but it remains a possible threat. And
you said something to the effect in your essay that the children of Europe used to be called cannon fodder, and here in the United States they are television and radio fodder.
Well, after all, you can read in the trade journals the most lyrical accounts of how necessary it is to get hold of the children, because then they will be loyal brand buyers later on.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, again, you just translate this into political terms. The dictator says they will be loyal ideology buyers when they're grown up.
We hear so much about brainwashing as used by the communists. Do you see any brainwashing other than that which we've just been talking about that is used here in the United States? Other forms of brainwashing?
Not in the form that has been used in China and in Russia, because this is essentially the application of propaganda methods, the most violent kind, to individuals. It's not a shotgun method like mm-hmm. the advertising method. It's a way of getting hold of the person and playing both on his physiology and his psychology till he really breaks down, and then you can implant a new idea in his head. I mean, the descriptions of the methods are really blood-curdling when you read them, and not only the methods applied to political prisoners, but the methods applied, for example, to the training of the young communist administrators and missionaries. They receive an incredibly tough kind of training, which causes about 25% of them to break down or commit suicide, but produces 75% of completely one-pointed fanatics.
The question, of course, that keeps coming back to my mind is this. Obviously, politics in themselves are not evil. Television is not in itself evil. Atomic energy is not evil. And yet you seem to fear that it will be used in an evil way. Why is it that the right people will not, in your estimation, use them? Why is it that the wrong people will use these various devices and for the wrong motives?
Well, I think one of the reasons is that these are all instruments for obtaining power, and obviously the passion for power is one of the most moving passions that exist in man, and after all, all democracies are based on the proposition that power is very dangerous and that it's extremely important not to let any one man or any one small group have too much power for too long a time. After all, what are the British and American constitutions accept devices for limiting power, and all these new devices are extremely efficient instruments for the imposition of power by small groups over larger masses.
Well, you ask this question yourself in Enemies of Freedom. I'll put your own question back to you. You ask this: in an age of accelerating overpopulation, of accelerating overorganization, and ever more efficient means of mass communication, how can we preserve the integrity and reassert the value of the human individual? You put the question. Now here's your chance to answer it, Mr. Huxley.
Well, this is obviously, first of all, it's a question of education. I think it's terribly important to insist on individual values. I mean, what is there is a tendency, as you probably read a book by White, The Organization Man, a very interesting, valuable book, I think, where he speaks about the new type of group morality, group ethic, which speaks about the group as though the group were somehow more important than the individual. But this seems, as far as I'm concerned, to be in contradiction with what we know about the genetical makeup of human beings, that every human being is unique. And it is, of course, on this genetical basis that the whole idea of the value of freedom is based. And I think it's extremely important for us to stress this in all our educational life. And I would say it's also very important to teach people to be on their guard against the sort of verbal booby traps into which they're always being led, to analyze the kind of things that are said to them. Well, I think there is this whole educational side, and I think there are many more things that one could do to strengthen people and to make them more aware of what was being done.
You're a prophet of decentralization.
Well, yes, if this is feasible. It's one of the tragedies, it seems to me. I mean, many people have been talking about the importance of decentralization in order to give back to the voter a sense of direct power. I mean, the voter in an enormous electorate feels quite impotent, and his vote seems to count for nothing. This is not true where the electorate is small and where he is dealing with a group which he can manage and understand. And if one can, as Jefferson, after all, suggested, break up the units into smaller and smaller units and so get a real self-governing democracy.
Well, that was all very well in Jefferson's day, but how can we revamp our economic system and decentralize and at the same time meet militarily and economically the tough challenge of a country like Soviet Russia?
Well, I think the answer to that is that there are, it seems to me that the production, industrial production, is of two kinds. I mean, there are some kinds of industrial production which obviously need the most tremendously high centralization, like the making of automobiles, for example. But there are many other kinds where you could decentralize quite easily and probably quite economically, and that you would then have this kind of decentralized life. After all, you begin to see it now if you travel through the South, this decentralized textile industry which is springing up there.
Mr. Huxley, let me ask you this, quite seriously. Is freedom necessary?
As far as I'm concerned, it is,
yes. Why? Is it necessary for a productive society?
Yes, I should say it is. I mean, a genuinely productive society. I mean, I think you could produce plenty of goods without much freedom, but I think the whole sort of creative life of man is ultimately impossible without a considerable measure of individual freedom, of that initiative, creation, all these things which we value, and I think value properly, are impossible without a large measure of freedom.
Well, Mr. Huxley, take a look again at the country which is in the stance of our opponent anyway it would seem to be there, Soviet Russia. It is strong and getting stronger economically, militarily. At the same time, it's developing its art forms pretty well. It seems not unnecessarily to squelch the creative urge among its people, and yet it is not a free society.
It's not a free society, but here is something very interesting, that those members of the society, like the scientists, who are doing the creative work, are given far more freedom than anybody else. I mean, it's a privileged aristocratic society, in which, provided that they don't poke their noses into political affairs, these people are given a great deal of prestige, a considerable amount of freedom, and a lot of money. I mean, this is a very interesting fact about the new Soviet regime, and I think what we're going to see is a people on the whole with very little freedom, but with an oligarchy on top enjoying a considerable measure of freedom and a very high standard of living.
And the people down below, the epsilons down below,
enjoying very little.
And you think that that kind of situation can long endure?
I think it can certainly endure much longer than a situation in which everybody is kept down. Because, I mean, they can certainly get their technological and scientific results on such a basis.
Well, the next time that I talk to you then, perhaps we should investigate further the possibility of the establishment of that kind of a society, where the drones work for the queen bees up above.
Well, but yes, but I must say I still believe in democracy. If we can make the best of the creative activities of the people on top plus those of the people on the bottom, so much the better.
Mr. Huxley, I surely thank you for spending this half hour with us, and I wish you Godspeed, sir.
Thank you.
Aldous Huxley finds himself these days in a peculiar and disturbing position. A quarter of a century after prophesying an authoritarian state in which people were reduced to ciphers, he can point at Soviet Russia and say, I told you so. The crucial question, as he sees it now, is whether the so-called free world is shortly going to give Mr. Huxley the further dubious satisfaction of saying the same thing about us.
So there you go.
Well, that was really fascinating to me anyway, and there are so many points where we could enter into a a conversation about how this relates to where we are, how it relates to the rollout of 5G and the whole freedom movement phenomenon. What struck you most about it, Nancy?
Mike Wallace saying, let me ask you seriously, do we need freedom?
Right, that was weird.
That was very weird. I caught it the first time I listened to it. And the second time I listened to it, it was, because I once you listen to something the second time, you get a little more. And in listening to Mike, he's a brilliant interviewer, first off.
Yeah.
But he also was indicating to me, in the way he was presenting even the questions, that he indeed had many, many reservations about what he was seeing already in 58 about the control.
And meaning Mike Wallace?
Mike Wallace. Mike Wallace.
Yeah.
You know? And so when he asked that question, and I heard it for the second time, it was almost a stark contrast to what I had been reading from him in this last listening. It was kind of like, wow, you know? I mean, maybe that is the question for a lot of those people. What do we need freedom for, as long as we're taken care of?
Right, and that's a classic line. I think, Benjamin Franklin said, something very much to the point on that. The exact quote is escaping me, but, that surrendering, those who surrender their freedom don't deserve to have it in the first place.
I think you might be thinking of the quote where you said, if you give up your freedom for security, you will have neither or neither.
Oh, yeah. There you are. That's it. And the rosy picture he painted of life in Soviet Russia in 1958, I thought, and maybe it's only because of what we know since then. But, as an actor in Chicago and New York in the 70s and 80s, when I met, people from the Soviet Union, artists, costume designers, people from the Czech Republic, who friends of mine worked with in the theater, where the idea that they're, creative impulses were, had any kind of free rein. A costume designer from the Soviet Union who interned at the Guthrie Theater in Minneapolis confided to an actress friend of mine. She said, "We are slaves and nothing more." And what Huxley finally brought out as well, what tends to happen, the intelligentsia, the scientists, the upper levels of the Politburo and the rest of it, well, they have nicer Dachas, I think they're pronounced correctly, with their nice country houses. They have a nicer standard of living. And then, you know, the proletariat, which is supposedly all happily working for the good of each other, the good of the masses, are actually crushed. Their freedom is crushed. Their standards of living are pathetic. But it goes back to George Orwell's other classic novel, Animal Farm, whereas the, you know, the wonderful revolutionary slogan, all animals are created equal, by the end of the book is slightly amended. All animals are equal, but some animals are more equal than others, right? And this is what Huxley points out. There's an oligarchy on top that is enjoying the benefits of the system, that is pushing the propaganda that, oh, it's, you know, all for the masses, and isn't it wonderful to be part of the masses? Well, yeah, except that every single individual in the masses is living a life of oppression and misery. But it's all for the good of some, you know, faceless concept called the masses. And this is collectivism, as it's also known, which is a really insidious thing, which we're now seeing pushed, you know, in globalism.
Political correctness. Actions,
the United Nations. Yeah, all that, you know. So that's, I think, what we are looking at now with the attack on what I refer to as healthy nationalism. They're slowly, you know, turning nationalism into a bad word. Like, for example, Hillary Clinton is very fond of decrying nationalism. Well, you know, John F. Kennedy was a nationalist, self-identified and proud of it, and naturally so. And it wasn't something you questioned. America for the Americans, right? Within the context of harmonious relations between nations and an observance of internationally recognized human rights. That was the idea. But now, I mean, the very idea of supporting and nurturing and preserving your national culture, language, your heritage, you know, as a sovereign nation state within the context of, you know, peaceful international relations. That is now under attack, you know, for along these same lines that Huxley is talking about, where it's all being watered down so that we're all, you know, happily surrendering our individuality and our freedom in the name of some, you know, lovely globalist community, which is a sham operated by the oligarchs, because ultimately the system has only one purpose, which is to preserve the power of the oligarchy. And, you know, that's what goes on, whether you're talking about, you know, Soviet totalitarianism or fascist totalitarianism or, you know, whatever blend of it is currently going on behind the scenes in the West, you know, with the corrupt financial elite doing the circus, the puppeteers doing the circus of the right-left, red-blue, divisive, you know, circus show, so that we don't see what is going on behind the scenes, so that we're distracted and divided and actually think that there's something going on called democracy, which is, you know, the point of so much of what Huxley says.
Well, now let's just take a look back at what we're looking at here. When you were talking to the people that were from Russia, what time frame was that? Because you were a toddler in 58 when this went off.
Right. Well, I'm talking about the late 70s and early 80s. I'm talking pre-Gorbachev. You know, this is pre-Perestroika, pre-Glasnost. And that was, you know, a pretty scary time. We're talking the end of the Brezhnev era, you know, and then there were the two, I think there were two brief Soviet premiers, their names are escaping me, before Gorbachev came in. And, you know, the, like, for example, when I was with, as Gorbachev started to loosen things up, I was with Chicago Shakespeare Repertory in like 87, I think it was 88. And so the Soviet Union was still in place. The Iron Curtain was still in place. Eastern Europe was still, you know, under Soviet domination. The Warsaw Pact, the Soviet bloc was all still in place. And we had visitors from a theater in Czechoslovakia, which, of course, is now the Czech Republic and Slovakia. And they saw a dress rehearsal of our production of Antony and Cleopatra. And afterwards, they talked to the artistic director, Barbara Gaines, and said, these are people who are in a creative field in the theater as writers and directors. And in order to express themselves, they had to be subversive. They had to have characters in a play that the audience could see were representative of certain aspects of the regime or were representative of what life was like under this manner of oppression, but it couldn't be open. It had to be subversive. You know, they had to see what they could get away with without ending up in jail. And so they went to Barbara Gaines after seeing our performance of Antony and Cleopatra, which was, you know, good. These are professional actors, and, you know, we knew our stuff. And so they asked Barbara, they said, we don't understand. What are your politics? And she was clueless. She said, politics? What do you mean? It's, you know, it's Antony and Cleopatra. It's ancient Roman Egypt. It's, well, actually, if you get down to it, this is a little bit of a tangent, but forgive me. Antony and Cleopatra is a Shakespeare play written in Elizabethan England, and it's exactly what Shakespeare was doing, is the same as these Czech actors and directors had to do. It's a subversive commentary on Queen Elizabeth and her court. That's what's going on in Antony and Cleopatra. Anyway, so the contact that I was having with these people, this is, you know, late Soviet Union, Glasnost, Perestroika, Gorbachev time. And that's when, you know, the whole apple cart was beginning to topple in the Soviet Union, because here you have Mike Wallace talking about how, oh, they are making economic progress. They're a strong nation.
But that was 1958.
Yeah. So lo and behold, 30 years later, you know, Gorbachev had to institute Perestroika and Glasnost because he saw the Soviet Union was falling apart economically. And Reagan pushed them with, you know, SDI, and they had to overspend militarily, and the whole thing just, they saw we have to somehow, you know, retool this thing. And of course, it was too late. You couldn't retool it, and it fell apart in 1989.
Well, I've got a little different take on it, because at the time that we're talking, all that time frame, I was a Soviet expert out of college. I just took Russian and Soviet, you know, Soviet sociology, everything that had Soviet Russian stuff. I was fascinated with it. But what I really take away from the time frame that we're talking here is that in 58, you've got Wallace and Huxley discussing a country that had just been virtually devastated by World War II. I mean, 1 out of 10 people in the Soviet, or Russia at that time, well, Soviet Union, but it was really Russia, died in the war. It was incredibly damaging. The Russians themselves retreated in front of the Nazis and burned their own machinery, their factories, everything they could, the, you know, burnt earth policy. This country, if you watch it and what happened with it, it is a collection. I have always felt that Russian people and American people are very, very close in the way that they, their basic perception of reality and their ability to overcome hardship. I love their culture that comes out of their, you know, beingness in their songs and their art, and you know, they're just very, very, in many ways to me, very similar to Americans. So what happens is that you have the, yes, it was getting worse and worse and worse the more, because they couldn't control it. I mean, why did it actually start to fall economically was, yes, that they were mucking with the finances, but let's just put that aside. Because one of the problems that you have in that kind of a, let's say, situation, is that you're trying to control everything from the top. And so they'd have these five-year plans. And they would say, well, we're going to make 400 tractors, so that means that we need 800 sets of tires. And, you know, you'd go through this whole planning. Well, that's not the way life is. Sometimes you need two tractors. You know, the other ones are fine. So they couldn't, this was before computers, you know, they couldn't control all of the economic stuff that you would need for ultimate control of the economy and therefore the people. And when I was studying them in the late 60s, early 70s, the people were making, it was like a black market, and let's just look at it from the standpoint of potatoes. They all had these communal jobs where they were supposed to give the potatoes to the state, but in reality they were planting potatoes everywhere they could, and they had a bigger black market in potatoes than they were actually making on the communal farms. So very, very interesting kind of people. But if you want to control those people, you're going to, they're hard to control. They're like Americans. You know, push comes to shove, and they're going to shove back. And one of the key things that, you know, we used to say about the Russians was that in Russia, they are, have complete propaganda control over what the people are hearing. But the people know it, so they don't believe it. But in America, we think it's free information and good, clean information, so we swallow it, and guess what? It's the best propaganda out there. You know?
Yeah. Yeah, I hear you. I thought about that when Huxley and Wallace were talking about subliminal advertising. Subliminal means of you know, reaching past the conscious mind, past your reason, past your freedom of choice, and influencing you in ways you don't realize you're being influenced. And that is so sophisticated now.
Let me give you an example of it, because, and this is a few years back. It was before I wrote Cosmic Reality, because I had the picture in it. But this woman was, her mother needed a close-up of herself, you know? And so to check the lighting, this woman, the daughter, took a selfie. And unbeknownst to her, when she took the selfie, she was just checking the light. Behind her is a television set, okay? So, but she sees the light. She's focused on the light. She says, yeah, Mom, light's good here. We'll take the picture. Well, sometime after that, when she went to delete, you know, stuff from her phone, she comes across the picture, only this time she's like confused as to what it is, and so she's studying it a little bit more, and then she looks at the television, and the television actually had the word kill up on the television, backwards. I think it's backwards. Now, it was just as, you know, she would have had to have hit that button at the instant that this thing came up, because it was subliminal. If you had sat there and watched it, your eyes wouldn't have seen it. So, you know, it's kind of, you know, spirit mucking with people, getting them to see something. But this is the stuff that we can get hit with all the time and not even realize it.
Yeah, there was a time in Chicago during my acting career there where I was called to audition for a commercial that it was a Kellogg cornflake commercial. And really, the script was one of the cleverest and funniest that I'd seen, and certainly not characteristic of what you tend to see from Kellogg of Battle Creek. It was something that John Cleese of Monty Python would have been perfect for. And it was a very, very tricky thing to pull off. So basically, imagine, if you will, a John Cleese type. You know, you see John Cleese on the screen. And this, you know, so this is the late 1980s. So younger John Cleese than whom we see today. He addresses this thing of subliminal advertising right up front. And he's talking about, you know, there are some in the world who use this Luciferian technology called subliminal advertising. Well, at Kellogg's of Battle Creek, we would never do that, soft, crisp flakes. We would never use such devious means if you want them now. You know, and this kind of thing where he's trying to pull off subliminal advertising in the middle of his speaking, right? You know, suddenly he'll drop his voice to a whisper and say, you want this now. Well, we would never do this. It was just really a hilarious send-up of the concept of subliminal advertising. But, you know, on a much more sophisticated level, this is what they do. And there are ways of inserting, you know, just brief flashes of words or images that go right past the conscious mind, go right to the subconscious. And, you know, that's why I don't watch television. I mean, I watch... I'm sure they managed to get it onto your laptop. It's probably all over YouTube. But, you know, these days I'm watching informative stuff and then stand-up comics and romantic comedies to just, you know, keep me laughing and keep my spirits up. So, but I'm sure that, you know, they're trying to get it everywhere they can. But it's not on Cosmic Reality Radio or Radio 5G, ladies and gentlemen.
As far
not
as we know.
Worry. Watch it now. Want to watch it now. Right.
Oh my
yeah.
gosh. What stood out? What stood out to you in the interview?
Well, you know, the for one thing, I love Mike Wallace as an interviewer. He's so concise. There's no time wasted. He's respectful but pointed, and you know, he really had a grasp of the big picture, and you know, to hear. Aldous Huxley, who was just really a giant of the 20th century, as far as I'm concerned, in terms of you know his impact, his range, his depth, and his insights. That you know, as a glance backward, okay, you know, so 1958. That's what 42. It's 62 years ago, whatever it is. That talking about mass communication as a potential threat to freedom, talking about decentralization as the answer that could help us to forestall or prevent this catastrophic loss of freedom. I mean, that's what we're seeing playing out now, because you have the irony that the internet is both potentially, you know, the greatest means of control for the elite, and potentially, you know, the greatest means of freedom, because they cannot control it all yet. I mean, obviously they're doing their darndest, and between you know their censorship on Google and Facebook and the rest of it, people's opinions are being controlled on a mass level, but. There's a wonderful book by Huxley called The Perennial Philosophy, and that's an anthology of the writings of mystics, East and West, Buddhist, Hindu, Christian, Muslim, on you know the underlying reality that all of creation is essentially one that. You know, as quantum physics will tell you, there is a hidden unity that is masquerading in a play of light and shadows that convince us that it has a separate reality, and actually it's a hidden unity. And then he addresses, he says, so, okay, so what kind of society would be ideal to allow spiritual growth and freedom for human beings? When we look at the totalitarian states, the you know, and he was writing just after World War II, so talking about the, you know, the fascist dictatorships of you know Japan and Nazi Germany. What kind of arrangement would be ideal? You know, what blend of sufficient freedom to allow us to be fully human and to allow us to seek oneness with spirit, and at the same time. Enough organization and enough cohesiveness to be able to defend ourselves. And he said, you know, the ownership of the means of production on a small scale, decentralized, such that we cannot be controlled by, for example, a mass electric grid or a mass communications grid. There would be, you know, shared values, and certainly there would need to be a defense apparatus, but that, you know, and this is what is happening now. This is what cryptocurrency is meant to facilitate. This is what off-the-grid solar power is meant to facilitate, you know, to free us from the corporatocracy that controls the means of production, the means of distribution. Obviously, it's a, you know, point of the you know, of the currency system with fiat currency and the Fed and the rest of it, to be able to completely centralize and control money, to get rid of cash, so that, you know, if you say the wrong thing on the internet in favor of something called the freedom movement, or identifying something called the corrupt elite, and suddenly you put your ATM card in, and guess what? You know, your life savings just got, just disappeared, just pip, because that's what money now is, and cash doesn't exist. That's the ultimate goal. So decentralization, this to me was the thing that really struck me in terms of its relevance for us when we talk about 5G, when we talk about, now obviously we know there's competition, or at least the appearance of competition. You know, you've got Huawei with the Chinese, and the Brits are upset about the possibility of surveillance. But there's a larger, you know, with the 20,000 low orbit satellites being put in place, there is a control grid being laid over humanity that, you know, allows them to finally have the upper hand against the trend toward decentralization. And if that trend goes too far, they're done. And I believe it has gone too far. And what we're seeing with 5G and the fight to stop the rollout, it's all about local sovereignty, local municipalities, counties, states asserting their right to take care of their citizens, and fighting back against the central governments being in bed with the, you know, the big telecom companies, the corporatocracy, the way the FCC has been sold out to the big telecom companies, which are in turn controlled by the puppeteers above those puppeteers in the corrupt financial elite. So this is, to me, the most promising thing that I heard Aldous Huxley say in this interview, and the thing that I think we can see happening with 5G, with you know, the growth of the movement to stop it. So anyway, we're at our hour break here. Do you have some music for us, Nancy, before we come back here on Radio 5G?
I do, and it's the only one I can think really fits. It's Disturbance of Sounds of Silence. But before we go, he gave the two things, decentralization and education.
Yeah.
And that's where we're at, education. So Disturbance's Sound of Silence, 4 minutes.
Flash of a neon light that split. silence. And in the naked light I saw 10,000 people, maybe more. People talking without speaking. People hearing without listening. People writing songs. And voices never shared. But no one dared disturb the sound of silence.
Wow. Well, that was about the coolest rendition of Simon and Garfunkel's Sounds of Silence that I've ever heard. Welcome back, everybody. This is Michael Henry Dunn on Radio 5G with Nancy Hopkins. And we are talking about this remarkable interview with the great English writer and philosopher Aldous Huxley from 1958 by Mike Wallace, a legendary journalist. So, and looking at this idea of what he saw coming, and he had written an essay on freedom, on the enemies of freedom, on the potential death of freedom. And this was at a time, of course, in 1958. It's the height of fear in the West of the Soviet Union and of the communist threat. And it, you know, to listen to this now in 2019 in the context of the rollout of 5G, and what, you know, we are seeing as the great hope and encouraging news that we have, as the, you know, just the growth of the movement to stop 5G, we're seeing it everywhere. And it all, to me, it comes very much down to this dynamic that Huxley describes. Of decentralization and, of course, as Nancy just pointed out, education, that the oligarchy has made a very concerted effort, both through propaganda in mass media and through control of the educational process of our children, to, you know, to create obedient drones. And I also love, I'd love for you to elaborate a little bit on this, Nancy, what you were talking about, the similarities of character between the Russian people and the American people. You know, that the Russians were being fed constant propaganda, but they knew it and they didn't buy it. And, you know, so the 5-year plan, the 10-year plan calls for the collective farms to plant this many potatoes. But on the side, you know, they're taking care of themselves and their families by black market potatoes. There was something I read about in the 80s in the Soviet Union where, you know, a Russian mother, any Russian mother of that time, not of the elite, but of the masses, when she would leave the house for any reason, would carry with her what was called a perhaps bag. And it wasn't that she was going, oh, I'm going to go down to the market because we need potatoes and baking powder and we need some coffee and we need some onions, had a list. No, because those shelves were so empty so often that they'd have a perhaps bag, because if perhaps there was anything on the shelves, you would buy it. No matter what it was, didn't matter if you need it, if you needed it, if it was on your list, you would buy it, because where the Soviet economy really operated was the black market. Because if you didn't need it, chances are your neighbor would need it, and you'd need something your neighbor had, or, you know, your neighbor's mother-in-law might need it. And so, you know, you're going to buy the spare part for a sewing machine that you don't absolutely need, because three or four people down the line of the black market, you know, trading of this for that might need it. So that's the reality they were working in. What I think is happening is that gradually that, you know, innate don't push me around, don't tread on me characteristic in the American people is now waking up. That, like the Russians, we're beginning to wake up to the propaganda. We're no longer buying it. You know, CNN's viewership is falling. So is Fox. You know, so are these propaganda organs on both sides. And, of course, the alternative journalism, there's all kinds of controlled opposition sites, disinformation sites. You know, we all know that's a classic counterintelligence tried and true strategy of, you know, so many of these so-called alternative news sites are in fact, you know, 90% authentic and 10% disinformation. That's the ratio, right, Nancy, that allows you to control people?
I'm sorry, what was that again, the ratios?
Well, I was just talking about
how the American people are waking up. I didn't hear it. What was the I heard 10%. I didn't hear what the first one was.
Okay.
What was your last statement?
That the ratio for effective disinformation to influence that demographic that you want to mislead, you have to give them, it's like, okay, light workers and freedom workers, come to our channel. You give them 90% real stuff so that they feel like they're on board with their peeps. And then 10% is the disinformation that, you know, which is going to be a key piece of disinformation to get them to no longer believe in a key figure, to smear someone's reputation, to take somebody down. It's like, well, they give me 90% real information. Gosh, this must be real too. That it's a 90-10 ratio of authentic information to disinformation. That's what I've heard, you know,
that,
from various...
No, that sounds very, very close to it. Somebody said to me the other day, they were talking about somebody that was had a YouTube presence, and they had subscribers over 300,000, right? And as soon as I heard that, I said, oh, I said, I'd be careful of that place. And it was like, why? And I said, because of the amount of acknowledgement of 300,000 that YouTube is giving this place. Because if somebody is really saying what the truth is, and they've got that kind of a membership, it's likely YouTube is not going to let anybody know that there's actually that many subscribers. I said, I suspect that this person might be, like you say, a 90-10. You know, that they're out there seemingly, and most of these people don't even know, you know, that they're being used. They're the ones who never have a problem with their websites. The websites are always solid. YouTube, they get, you know, within a matter of a fraction of a second, they get, you know, 10,000 hits. You know, I mean, it's like there are groups of people that are out there that don't even know this. There are people out there that know this. But there's a lot of them out there that they don't realize that that little 10% bad information is part of an agenda that is, you know, right behind, it's like behind the curtain.
Yeah, it reminds me of when I was in Indonesia in 2013. I was doing freelance journalism on the emerging story of the global collateral accounts. David Wilcock was also covering that, as were, you know, Carrie Cassidy, Project Camelot. And I had produced a brief video that gave a pretty engaging, like, 7-minute overview of the history of central banking and the global collateral accounts and, you know, the Japanese empire and how it all came to be consolidated in the Fed. And then there's JFK and his attempt to cut the legs out from under the Fed. And there's Dallas and 9/11, et cetera. So, but it was pretty compelling. And as I was, you know, working on this story in Indonesia, David Wilcock carried this video. And it got 50,000 hits overnight, and then another 50,000. And then we had contacts with intelligence sources as we were doing the work in Jakarta on, you know, further exposing the story of the global collateral accounts. And word came to us that, oh, by the way, the number of views of that video, YouTube is showing it at, you know, 100,000, and then it stopped. It said, well, you guys need to know that millions of people have seen that video, but YouTube is not going to reflect that fact. And this was, you know, I don't know exactly what the sources were. They were, you know, good guy factions in CIA, presumably. But yeah, that's, the ones that have an open audience that YouTube is telling you, oh, look, they've got, you know, 500,000 subscribers. Chances are, that the propagandists are perfectly happy to let the 10% disinformation go out through that source and get you to regard it as being a mainstream, you know, highly followed channel, right?
Absolutely. And, you know, I just was flashing back to Huxley. So you've read, I don't even know if I've ever read any of his books, but you've read about his spiritual outlook, let's say.
Right.
Okay. To me, that spiritual outlook is what we have to promote in our own activities every day. And one of the simplest things I can tell you is that when you go onto a YouTuber, even more than YouTube, the website of the person that you might be looking at, sit there and feel the energy. Just feel that energy.
Yeah.
And if you don't like it, then dismiss it. Because your body is so unique, but so unbelievably receptive to information at the etheric energetic level. And if we don't begin to, why do these, oh, trust your gut. Why do they say trust your gut? Well, because in this massively complicated but simplistic system that we have, every one of our cells has a miniature quantum computer. That quantum computer is connected to everybody else in the cells of this person. But within the gut, in that vortex of energy that is, you know, very basic to who and what you are, there is neurons, like in your brain, like in your heart. Did you know you have more neurons in your heart than you do in your brain? Why do we think that the
right.
consciousness is in the brain? It's in the heart. But there is a third collection of neurons in the stomach, not the stomach area, the lower area, your intestinal, your not quite into the sexual area, but sort of in between those two, you know, those two chakras, is a neuron network. And that neuron network is what is making you feel, trust your gut. Okay? Because it responds, you know, like, no, I don't like that. And you feel it in your gut. I mean, I actually get nauseous. As soon as I start getting nauseous, man, I'm out of wherever I'm at. I know that that's my warning, not good energy. But if we just, you know, even if you think we're crazy and you want to just imagine it, just start playing with it. See what happens.
Yeah, that's discernment. You know, we tell everybody, hey, we're just telling you what we know, and you can believe it or not, but educate yourself. And then use your own discernment about whether what you're seeing is real. And discernment means not only, you know, your logic and your recall of what you've heard from other people, but that intuition. And it's a tricky thing, you know, in meditation, for example. You know, we often talk about the development of intuition. How can you begin to trust your intuition? How do you know that that network of neurons connected to your heart and the brain is giving you that subtle signal? Whether it's like for you, Nancy, it's, you know, a slightly nauseous feeling of, you know, just some kind of disorientation, misalignment, you know, tilt thing going on. And what I've seen recommended by meditation masters, shall we say, is that, you know, if you're practicing a meditation technique that allows you to slow the thoughts down and experience the essence of the soul as, you know, pure consciousness, that as you are praying for guidance from spirit by, you know, whatever aspect draws your heart, and then it's like, all right, now I need to make a decision in life today. Do I go this way or that way? And, you know, sit with it, educate yourself, take a step in one direction, see how it turns out, test your intuition. And then you'll have a certain feeling that tells you, yes, I should go this way. Does it work out? Was that sound advice? Is your intuition reliable? And that as you meditate more, your intuition becomes more accurate, more powerful. You begin to trust it. And it, you know, because in the beginning, we could be our intuition, and it could be our ego whispering in our ears. It could be, you know, what we wish were true. And then, okay, take a step in that direction, see how that turns out. Get back to me on how that works out for you, right? So anyway, it's, yeah, this discernment thing when it comes to disinformation and the, you know, the sites out there. And as you say, Nancy, it's not always, you know, people operated by nefarious evildoers who are pulling the wool over your eyes. Most of the time, it's much more effective if the people in charge of those stations don't realize. I mean, you know, they're sincere. They don't realize that their source is feeding them a major disinformation dynamic. It's like, okay, we've got all your people on board now. Now let's twist it. Now let's take it down the timeline that we want to take it down. Now let's tear down the reputation of a key person who is actually one of our most effective opponents, one of the most effective champions of freedom. Let's see if we can't just, you know, pull that person's reputation down in the eyes of this nice big audience of believers that we've managed to create. Anyway, it's,
let me just go back to the concept of meditation and blah, blah, blah. We don't have time for meditation. Okay. People want to sit and meditate. You don't have time, and nor is it necessary. Okay. Because right now you got your own mind, you know, that's probably working more in the left. But if you listen here, you probably got a lot of right side, you know, the spiritual side is just firing all over the place. What we have to do is get comfortable with success. So what I recommend, you're going through life and you've been doing this, you don't go off and meditate, or you try, but you can't seem to quite understand what it is. Every time you go through life, you're making decisions all day long. What do I want for breakfast? What do I want for lunch? Which way should I try to get there? You know, I mean, all the time you're making decisions. Well, let's just get yourself and think about it. You know, you're making a decision. Stop and go. Okay, I mean, make the decision. Make the decision that you're going to go to the right instead of the left. But stop at the moment before you actually activate that decision. And just check yourself. Say, okay, I'm going to go to the right. And feel what you feel. Then you go, okay, I'm going to go to the left. And feel what you feel. All right? And you don't have to agree with what you just, the left seems to feel better for me. But I still think in my head I'm going to go for the right. Because this is the only way you're going to train yourself to understand that, no, damn it, you should have taken the left.
Which,
yeah. You know, so we have to maintain, you know, this is, okay, we're at a point where we're way beyond, you know, elementary school. We're even beyond, you know, the high school level. We are into higher education, and that requires more presence, more focus, more taking control of your actual energetic beingness. And to do that, you've got to begin to experience, to push it. Okay, so just do it for, you know, get it as part of your daily routine. Okay, I'm going to go, which way do I feel is the best? And feel it, and then disregard it. You can go with your head. You don't have to follow it. But sooner or later, you're going to find out that every time you feel this good thingy, it's the place you should have gone to begin with. Because our bodies know much more than our brains.
It's true. Yeah, what you're saying about that we don't have time to meditate. There are going to be people like myself, for example, who for whatever reason, you know, karmically, where we are, combination of heredity and environment and soul history, want to meditate. And it took me a good long time to develop the discipline to have any kind of meditation practice. But not everybody's going to be like that. But we all have intuition. We all have it operating at some level or other. And I love the example you give there, Nancy, because before I started to really do a meditation practice, I had this perfect example of what you're describing where, you know, do I go left or do I go right? And it's one of those, you know, two paths diverged in a yellow wood. And, I took the path less traveled by, and it's made all the difference, Robert Frost. That this is in Chicago in the early 80s, and I was in a production at a theater there. And I was a single guy, and there were two women in this production that I was, you know, just becoming friendly with. And it just so happened that one night we came out of the theater after the performance, and I sort of had more or less an invitation to get together following the performance. From both of these women. They came out of the theater just ahead of me. One went to the left and one went to the right. I came out right behind them, and I stood there in front of the theater. I looked to the left at that woman. I looked to the right at the other woman. And it was one of those moments where, like, in the development of these relationships, you know, we're still just friends and colleagues, but it was sort of warming up, and I'm going, I'm a single guy, but I don't want to, you know, I'm a loyalty guy, and I don't know, what am I going to do? And it was one of those moments you go, do I go left? There's this timeline to the left, this future for your life to the left, and then a whole other timeline future to the right. Which way do I go? And it was a very, you know, clear feeling. And I went to the right and ended up, you know, following, catching up to, and, you know, having a beautiful visit with a woman who I later married. Anyway, yeah, it's one of those things where if I'd gone to the left, chances are I'd have gone like maybe 5 or 10 steps and gone, oh, this doesn't feel so good. I'm going back the other way. I think my intuition was just good enough at that point. But we all, you know, have these choices moment to moment every day. And that's that sense, that little voice that can tell us what's real and what's not as we're looking at all this disinformation out there, all these attempts to control our minds. So,
earlier when we were talking about, you know, that I'm saying, you know, we don't have time for meditation. It's like, what happens is that people learn how to meditate, and then they set it over there, and they have to have this environment, and they go through all this stuff. And what we need to do is understand that you can actually go through life in a meditative state. Okay, but that is the key to really becoming enlightened, and that's where we are going. But you got to carry it with you all the time. And this way that I'm saying that, you know, test yourself. This will begin to give you the understanding of this. When you empty your brain, when you go into a state where your brain's not doing in your head, okay, that perfect silence, that you can at that point know that the information you're getting is from your own body. It's not from anything that people have been telling you or what you think or, you know, all this other stuff. It's just pure messaging. But you need to learn how to trust it.
Well, and the thing about, you know, going through life in a meditative state, that is the goal. I agree totally with that. The trick is that, you know, at least in my experience, what I had to do was I had to, you know, find a practice of meditation so that I could have that peace and do my best to carry that into the day. So that, you know, because most of us, you know, we're walking around with all these pressures, all these distractions, being hit left, right, and center by EMF and Wi-Fi, you know, hit by propaganda, hit by fear-inducing stuff. And go, oh, wait a minute. Nancy Hopkins said on Radio 5G, I should be in a meditative state. Okay. Here we go. I'm in a meditative state. Oh, Jesus, I hope I am. You know, and, that it's just not that easy to switch it on for, you know, for where we are these days. I'm going to do a little, forgive me, a little self-plug here, which is I wrote a book. It's a devotional memoir called Romancing the Divine. You can find that on Amazon. Michael Henry Dunn, Romancing the Divine. But it was about my, you know, experience in, you know, my desire to achieve that ongoing meditative state. And that was in my own particular struggle. Everybody's got different circumstances. Some people can just meditate much more easily than I could, achieve that ongoing state where you're going through the day, you're in touch with your intuition, and you're able to make decisions that feel guided by your higher power. And for me, you know, devotional chanting and meditation was the path that enabled me to move through the world every day, you know, in a more meditative state where my intuition was accessible to me. And I have found in recent years that while I must be doing okay, because here I am talking with Nancy Hopkins on Radio 5G, and, you know, I'm doing my dharma. I mean, you know, life isn't a bed of roses, but I'm surrounded by the right people doing the right work. And so anyway, I hear you. It's kind of a blend to me. I mean, some people, I think, for example, like yourself, you know, with your clairvoyant gifts, your intuitive gifts, whatever your soul history is, you know, that ability to move through the day in a meditative state where your discernment and your intuition are right there available for you, right, left, you know, ketchup or mustard, Joe or Jill or whatever, you know, whoever you're going to talk to, that it's there for you. And some of the rest of us, like me, you know, I needed to leave my acting career and become a vegetarian cook in a monastery for a couple of years to get a meditation practice going.
See, the thing of it is that it's tricking the brain to go into a meditative state. Okay, because what is a meditative state? A meditative state is this state where there is no thought coming into your head. You're not bringing it in by thinking. It's that, you know, something startles you and you go into a state of non-compute because you have no clue as to what is just there. So you stop and you observe. At that instant, you're in a state of meditative state because you become totally open to the observation of whatever startled you. Okay. Now, as soon as you start to get information, then your brain kicks in again and you start to process all the information as to what you have to do because you just got startled by whatever happened. Okay. But for that instant, you were in a meditative state. So if you understand that concept of non-thinking is the meditative state, because it allows you to observe things that you don't see if your brain is being clouded by all of the stuff. And so by doing simple techniques of stopping yourself and just to feel what you're feeling causes your brain to stop. Now you're focused on what you're feeling. You're in a meditative state. So this is what I'm saying, is you go through the day in a meditative state, one little moment after another. It's not like you walk around, you know, zoomed out. No. It's, you're very focused, but you know, okay, I mean, all I have to do is just focus on what I'm feeling. And sooner or later, you get to a point where you go, I just got to go there. And boom, you go there. You take a breather, and then you go on. Does that make sense?
Oh, yeah. It's like, what is the current fad, if you will, in, you know, meditation, at least what they're calling it in different categories, you know, mindfulness. This is the everywhere you look today, you know, it's, oh, you know, a course in mindfulness. Well, it's simply what you're describing, you know, that you are aware of your breathing, of your body, of, you know, you are being fully present to whatever it is you're doing, whether it's, you know, walking or eating or talking, but you're not allowing yourself to be distracted from the pure stream of consciousness. When I was a kid, you know, my dad was a holistic pediatrician, and he and my mom, who worked closely with him in his practice, they had us all, when, you know, 10 kids, okay, this is an Irish Catholic family in Chicago, Oak Park, Illinois, to be precise, 10 kids, had us all take Silva Mind Control. This is in the 70s. And so that's about, you know, putting your three fingers together and inducing, self-inducing an alpha brainwave state wherein you're able to self-anesthetize if you're, you know, dealing with an injury or a headache and you're not able to, you know, get to a doctor in medicine. It's about self-diagnosis, remote viewing, you know, I mean, demonstration of ESP and clairvoyant abilities, which is innate in all of us and which certain techniques can bring out. And so, you know, when I'm 14, 15 years old, me and all my brothers and sisters were learning how to do this. And my dad, in his practice, did exactly what you're describing, Nancy. He, you know, he's seeing patients, and he's just quietly putting his three fingers together, because over the course of the Silva Mind Control thing, you know, you, through various breathing patterns and exercise, you eventually were able to trigger an alpha brainwave state simply by putting your three fingers together. So my dad would just have his three fingers together as he's sitting with a patient. And an intuition would come to him. It's like, is this 1,000 cc's of vitamin C this person needs? No. 1,000 milligrams or whatever. You know, that he would just be subtly guided, and that he would receive intuitions about what the real problem was. And, you know, this was his ongoing way of doing that. And there was this beautiful psychotechnology of the Silva Mind Seminars. Jose Silva, pretty remarkable man, had created. So, yeah, that, you know, there are scientific ways to develop this. And it's curious, those courses in Silva Mind Seminars, as I think they're now called, we all thought that was just going to sweep the country back in the day. And to some extent it did. But, you know, it's remarkable to me that is not, you know, that it didn't achieve the wide distribution that we all thought it would. That, oh, you know, there's a rosy future ahead of us when everybody knows how to work with this.
Oh, because the propaganda got it so that it was the devil behind it. I mean, I'm saying that because I'm familiar with it. But not from the way you just presented it. I'm familiar with it as some kind of a mind control. I mean, that was the propaganda that got to me. That's why I didn't go.
Right. It was. I think mind control was an unfortunate name. That's what it was called in the beginning, Silva Mind Control. It wasn't about controlling anybody else's mind. It was simply about controlling your own mind and body for, you know, in healthy, beneficial ways.
And so somebody's going to control your mind, so it might as well be you.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
I'm going to have to look into this some more because, like I say, I can tell you why it didn't go because of the way that I'm bringing up memories of it, and I'm going like, no, that was presented to the, at least me, as being something to avoid. We didn't hear the good part.
Yeah, which is, that's amazing to me, you know, because it was so benign. I mean, I knew the people and, you know, who were teaching it. And, you know, there was never any indication that these techniques could be used to control other people or to bend them to your will or any of that stuff. In fact, they would say, okay, if you are programming for a certain goal, something you want to have happen, and that this was one of the major things that you would do, you know, you would gaze slightly up at, you know, at what in meditation we call the Christ Consciousness Center or the spiritual eye, and, you know, for a certain number of minutes per day, visualize a certain goal you wanted to achieve. And then say, well, you know, chances are opportunities will unfold, you know, synchronicities will come into play, and this thing will be achieved. But if it doesn't happen, we have learned that it's because it is apparently not in accordance with the cosmic plan. It's like, oh, there's a cosmic plan. Well, I thought to myself, I came back from New York City in my early 20s, and I wanted to get some kind of spiritual path going. I thought, well, I've been practicing Silva, but there's this thing called the cosmic plan. Wouldn't it make more sense to affirm some kind of harmony with the cosmic plan to start with, so you're not doing a hit and miss with your own personal desires? And that, you know, in Christian terminology, that's simply thy will be done. You know, that's what that's about. So, you know, that kind of started me down the path towards devotional meditation. But it is one of those things about Silva that they acknowledged that there was a divine plan, but pretty much what they offered was, well, you know, meantime, we're human beings with our desires and goals, so just keep doing the hit and miss thing, but if it doesn't happen, chances are it's not in accord with cosmic plan. Which could have all kinds of ramifications, maybe just, hey, you don't have the karma to, you know, to be an Olympic gymnast. You can program all you want. You don't have the body type or the training. It ain't going to happen. Sorry. You know, or it could be something more refined, such as this worthy goal and your skills is not in accordance with the karmic timeline of your higher destiny for your soul. Call it what you want, but it's a fascinating question.
Well, when I look back on how did I get to where I am now, I had so many really, really good ideas to make money. And something would always blow up in my face. And I can tell you that concepts I had for certain businesses, certain things, you know, somebody else was later to do these things. They would have worked. But they kept blowing up for me. And, I mean, I can't even tell. I was just one of these people. I was always doing something. You know, well, let's try this. Let's try that. I've had more businesses than most people would even have probably walked in the store to. I'm crazy like that. But the thing of it is that every single one of those failures, as it were, got me to where I'm got now. If I hadn't tried those things, I wouldn't be here where I am now. So,
yeah.
You know, even if you, and I mean, I would always start out, they'd all start out successful, and then, you know, something would go really wrong. But that's how we learn, is through the failures. But if we're not willing to attempt, we're not going to learn. You know, this is something that they programmed us with. You know, oh, failure is failure. It's terrible. You're getting embarrassed. You know, no, it isn't. Look at Donald Trump. How many times has he declared bankruptcy? You know, I mean, it's like, no, that's where you learn. That's where you, if you can't try, you don't ever fail. If you don't ever fail, you'll never learn. And we are in a position right now. The other thing that was interesting that they brought up in the interview was the concept of group over the individual. Because that is a very profound reality right now. I'm a Democrat. I'm a Republican. you know. And now they want the group to be the whole world. You're not supposed to think in terms of being an American. Somehow or another, if I say I am proud to be an American, I'm a bigot. What the hell is that about? You know?
Yeah.
It's making the group... Now, it's odd because I was thinking, okay, so they're essentially saying, you know, drop all of the national boundaries, so to speak. Your social identity, your culture, your traditions, drop all that for the concept of humanity. Well, we're basically saying the same thing, but it's totally a different messaging. It's like... Yeah, we're saying get together because we're unique individuals getting together to fix some problem. You're telling us get together because you're all the same. You're all just numbers.
Mm-hmm.
It's a profound difference. And they did. He touched on that. You know, what happens to a society that is group-oriented? It's the group, the group, the group, right? Well, okay, you're going to have some successes, but the creativity, the thing that makes us human, is gone.
Right. And it's also, I remember in the context of, I think it was Operation Desert Storm, where there was an essay out there somewhere talking about the military structure of the Iraqi army. And that because it was a police state under the terror tactics of the Saddam Hussein regime, that the way that translated into the military structure was in each military unit, there's an absence of ingenuity. There's an absence of an ability to adapt freely to an emerging situation because there's pervasive fear and, you know, a top down structure. I mean, yeah, every military has to have, you know, a chain of command and clarity in that chain of command and, you know, obedience to orders. But within, you know, a given objective to be achieved by some unit, the American Army had built into it because of, you know, kind of because of the American character and the way that would play out within, you know, the chain of command structure. Where these Iraqi guys were just terrified to make a false move, terrified to, you know, have their commander come down on them. And the commander is fearful of his life, you know, if he screws up because Saddam just would kill people. You know, it's the same kind of thing actually that you see played out in Star Wars. You know, you're some poor lackey comes up to Darth Vader and says, my lord, unfortunately, the Millennium Falcon has escaped. And they're gone. And the guy gets strangled and thrown to the floor. You know, it's that kind of thing. But it is this this initiative of the individual in cooperation for the greater good versus this totalitarian quashing of all individuality. And it's a complete bogus propaganda sham to get you to surrender your freedom for the benefit of, you know, an isolated oligarchic elite. That's what, time after time, folks, check it out. Every one of those, you know, idealistic, you know, the paradise is just around the corner if you surrender your freedom schemes. It's ultimately, time and again, it's about benefiting a tiny minority of oligarchic elite. Go back to ancient Greece and Rome and on forward. And that's what we're seeing playing out right now, only it's on a planetary scale.
Let's go back to Russia, okay? Because I don't think I really explained to you the connection that I see between the Russian people and the American people. Okay, Russia has a history that goes way beyond ours. Ours is, what, you know, a couple hundred plus years. Theirs is, you know, thousands of years. But when I was a Russian historian... And student of all part things Soviet Russian, I never realized that I didn't know about the indigenous peoples of Russia. It was like hidden history. And they hid it so well, I never even missed it. But then Walt and I got into reading the books, The Singing Cedars of Russia, with Anastasia, who lives in the Siberian northern wood area and is, in my estimation, a 3D representation of Gaia. Amazing series of books. So, Walton, you can go to YouTube and go to Cosmic Reality Radio, and you'll see we went through each of the books and talked about them. There's now 8 of them. But the thing of it is that when you start to realize that there's missing history there, and you start to learn the history of the Russian people, they were called the Vedrus, and their basic concept of organization was each family had a domain, a family plot, and that you worked with the other people around you for the betterment of all of these family plots, the domain. And they didn't have organized government or, I mean, of course it's, you know, kind of ancient, but, and they would just be, they were so spiritually connected to the land and to themselves. And, I mean, if you just let yourself get into the Vedrus kind of feeling, of course, you know, being a remote viewer, it was like, wow, these people are really cool. The thing of it is that it's completely taken away from any history books that were typically known to, especially to the West. But they had an image of themselves as being individuals working as a group. And that's exactly the same kind of people that came to America to settle America. You know, they came over as small groups. You didn't normally get on a boat and go by yourself. You went with your family. You know, you had brothers or sisters and, you know, friends, but you went as groups. And this is in the very early, you know, it was so one by one. And if you study the early, you know, migration from into America, into all of the Americans, you're finding people that are, because they have to be, they get connected to the land, because if they can't, there's nothing there except them and the land. That's why you see the successful settlements like, you know, the Puritans. They were working with the Native Americans, and the Native Americans, you know, are so spiritually connected. They know that everything has a reason for being. They know everything is a totem, an energy field. I mean, it's just the same things that has been called New Age, you know, but that was the Vedrus people, and that was the people that came to America. And the Vedrus people just simply disappeared. You know, there is no connection between them and the rest of, you know, where did they go? And there is a supposition that they were so connected, so spiritual, that when the priests came in, setting up governments and trying to take control, that they just said, we're not going to stay here, and that they actually went into another dimension. You know, and this is the history associated with this particular people. Just like in South America, I forget which tribe it was. Was it the Olmec? That, you know, there they are, a great society, and all of a sudden they just disappear. You know, and if I had said this even 5 years ago, people, oh, crazy person. But now, no, what I'm talking about is string theory of quantum physics and the fact that we have to have multiple universes, multiple versions of Earth. You know, so it gets very, very complicated if you realize that the universe is very complicated, but we only have to focus on what we're doing right here, the story that we're living right here. And that is that we are spiritual beings living in human bodies. And we have got to step into that role, because there's still a tremendous opposition behind us. I mean, in front of us. So, meditation and bringing it into your life, knowing whenever you've got a decision. Let's say somebody's, you know, your boss. Your boss comes in and says blah, 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 asking a question, or maybe even saying it in a way that puts you on the offensive. Instead of responding or doing anything, just sit there for a second. Okay? Just sit there and go, no compute, and read the energy of the person that is saying whatever they're saying to you. Because if you stop and you do that, you're going to keep from making a mistake. Because a lot of times what people say is not what they're meaning. And we react to what they said because they have put in our heads all these triggers. You know? Simple things are said to you and you take offense and you don't even really understand why. But these are triggers. Because there is subliminal programming all over the place.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's something that there's a little method that I heard a monk talk about one time. Like you talk about right here, Nancy, your boss walks in, says something that triggers you, puts you on the defensive. And if you don't respond, if you don't buy into the trigger, you just breathe for a second. Now you've accessed the power of silence. Now that could be regarded by your boss as being an intimidation move. Suppose you're just looking at him and you're expected to respond, but you maintain silence. That could be interpreted, felt by him as an intimidation move that you are claiming your ability to not be triggered, right? But there's another thing that we can do in a moment like that, which is to project to this person, unconditional positive regard. That will show up in your eyes. That will show up in the vibration and feeling that the other person picks up from you. And there's a particular way to do this. This monk talked about how when he would be counseling people, people come to them with their problems and they're going on and on. It's like, I'm a monk. I'm supposed to be listening with compassion and receptivity, and hopefully I'll say something wise soon, right? But he's, you know, finding himself kind of irritated, and this person's problems really aren't that big, and they're really kind of, you know, exhausting me. And when do I get to go have my, you know, pitiful monastic lunch here? And, you know, just observing that he was not really regarding them with love. So he said, all right, I'm just going to silently affirm as I look at them, look into their eyes, and as I listen, I'm going to silently affirm, I love you. I'm not doing some big, you know, romantic, unignorable, strange thing at them. It's just a silent affirmation. As I look at them, the words, I love you, silently, sincerely, from the heart, as I'm listening. I said, when he started to do this, everything changed. You know, suddenly their irritating quirks kind of became, you know, endearing foibles, and suddenly just the act of his listening to them was felt by them as having a healing power of its own. And that's simply because of the power of those three words, those three magical words, you know, that we all long to hear, really, but silently affirmed. And it just creates this very powerful vibration. So that's a way of, as Nancy's talking about here, you know, accessing this meditative state, non-reactive, claiming your sovereign power, but in a way that is going to help all of you, all of us, you know, is going to help truth to be arrived at, hopefully, a little more harmoniously. Well, we're coming up on a couple of minutes left in the program here, and I'm thinking about, okay, how do we, you know, bring this back around to where we are with the movement to halt the rollout of 5G. And, you know, really, I think this use, conscious use of the most powerful tools that we have, which are the spiritual and metaphysical ones. And they've got to be, you know, in tandem with the on-the-ground 3D municipalities, you know, upholding your sovereign right and doing all the pushback and using the criminal assault definition of the 5G rollout that's been so successful in Australia. And the real shift is going to take place at the consciousness level. That's where the restoration of our Mother Earth and the freedom of humanity, that's where that corner really gets turned. So let's do that. Anyway, you got any words of wisdom for us, Nancy, before we head out into Mr. McCartney?
Yeah, just hug yourself and grasp your own powers, which are just there waiting for you to pay attention. You know, it's not hard. It's just, you know, give yourself permission to, you know, to have your intuition make itself known. It'll be a lot easier because we don't, our little brains are not capable of really comprehending all of the intricacies of, like you alluded to, you know, the cosmic plan. You know, all we can do is within the context of the story that we're in right now, you know, become the cosmic plan.
Yeah, that's it. Exactly. So thanks, everybody, for being with us today on Radio 5G. This is a joint project of Cosmic Reality Radio and the Sacred Academy of Global Evolution in Crestone, Colorado. So be safe, everyone. God bless us, everyone. See you next time.
Thank you for listening. May it be. Let it